Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Well, welcome to the Al Franken podcast. This week, we're playing a conversation that I had with Dana Carvey when I first started recording these. And originally, it was not my intention to interview my comedian friends, but George H.W. Bush had just died. And Dana, of course, did H.W. on SNL. And I wrote or co-wrote a lot of those, especially with Jim Downey, a legendary SNL writer. But in 1988, when Reagan's second term was coming to an end, we were getting a little nervous because Dana just did not have a take on Bush. And Reagan was kind of easy to get a fix on and to get laughs. Now, some of you may remember Franken and Davis. That was me and my comedy partner. We met in high school, and we were there at the beginning of SNL back in 1975. We stayed until 1980 and then came back in 85. When Lorne came back, we were Lorne again. In those 5 years, we did a lot of college gigs. And we used to do Reagan in our act, and I would do the sort of, you know, the doddering Reagan. And this guy back in Minneapolis had made this thing for us where I could talk on the phone as Reagan backstage, and Tom could be on stage and be very excited about this call. It was coming in from the president, especially at colleges. A lot of college kids needed to know a lot about the presidency. And Reagan was calling in. The phone would ring. Tom would answer it, and I'd say into the phone, "The president of the United States will be right on the phone." And Tom would go, "Oh wow, this is so exciting!" And then a slide would go up on the screens on either side of the stage of Reagan at his desk on the phone with the phone up to his left ear, and I'd go, "Hello." And Tom would go, "Hello, Mr. President." "Hello." He'd go, "Mr. President?" "Tom, hello, hello." "Mr. President?" "Hello, hello, hello. Mr. President, are you having trouble hearing me?" "Oh, Tom, yes, I must have the phone up to my bad ear." He said, "Oh, that's right, Mr. President. I heard that you damaged one of your ears while on a movie set. And yeah, well, here, let me switch it." And then we'd switch it, the slides, and it would just be the same slide with his phone now on his right ear. And that'd get a laugh. That'd get a good laugh. And then he'd say, "Well, the gun went off by my ear." And it was like, "Was that during one of your many Westerns that you shot, sir?" "No, it was during the filming of Newt Rockne All-American. It was the halftime gun." "Well, Mr. President, I think the students have some questions for you." Well, that's good, Tom, because, you know, a lot of college students don't know that much about the presidency. For example, many think that William Howard Taft was the fattest president." "Huh. Well, I thought he was the fattest president." No, he was not." "Well, who was the fattest president, sir?" "I don't know." And so then Tom would start taking questions. And so Reagan, that was the doddering Reagan. Phil Hartman, when we came back in 85, again, Lornigan writer, started doing Reagan and kind of in that fashion. But if you kind of compare Reagan to Trump, Reagan was an actor, and of course he's going to have experience reading lines, reading and speaking at the same time, which is something that Trump is just not good at. And I watched the 4th of July speech, and he just is not good at reading and talking at the same time. And he blamed the Washington airport thing on the prompter. But if you know your speech, you know where you are, and you're in the 18th century. I'm sorry. The least he could do is go over the speech. When I would used to do an important speech, I'd go over it. I'd go over it 2, 3, 4, 5. I'd go over it until I had it. I've never seen, maybe a State of the Union. Maybe a State of the Union, they've made him go over it. But this was, well, let's play some of this.
The Continental Army suffered a bitter winter of Valley Forge, found glory across the waters of the Delaware, and seized victory from Cornwallis of Yorktown. Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do.
It can't be just pure talent lack. I just have to think, on top of everything else, this is the laziest president we've ever had. Look, he's honoring our brave soldiers, sailors, and Marines, and Coast Guardsmen and women, and all these pilots and crews are preparing for the flyover. So many people have prepared for this event. There's the National Park Workers. There's the Park Police, the D.C. Police. There's millions of people watching on TV. Just read through the friggin' speech a few times. And he's celebrating these armed forces. He's a guy who got out of Vietnam by having his doctor write a bullshit note saying that Donald had bone spurs. I mean, the whole speech was dedicated to our fighting men and women and their unbelievable sacrifice of blood and of life. And it was just all the more tacky that he could not have taken the slightest bit of effort to learn this speech. So now back to Dana and George H.W. Bush. Ronald Reagan was leaving. Phil Hartman had a clear handle for him. He did him great. But at that point, looking at George H.W. Bush, Dana had nothing. And if you listen to his first few attempts, Dana just did not have that handle. And we were going, oh boy, Bush is just kind of boring. And then Dana found him with, well, doing that thing over there, you know, in that whole area over there. And, you know, not gonna die, wouldn't be prudent. So we just started to rely on Dana's Bush because he could get laughs at will. And if anything happened that week that we could open with, we would do it. And we just rode Dana for the rest of Bush's term. And then, and of course, during the campaign, Dana got the gift of Ross Perot. So we had this crazy 92 season where the show just climbed on Dana's back, on Bush and Perot and on Phil Hartman's Clinton, but mainly Bush. Now, our depiction of H.W. Bush was never vicious, and Bush was gracious enough that after he lost, he invited Dana to the White House. This is after he lost. He'd been defeated, and he invites the guy who had ridiculed him for 4 years on TV, invites the guy to the White House. Now, can you imagine Donald Trump inviting Alec Baldwin to the White House if Trump, you know, loses next fall? Of course, Alec and SNL have been pretty unrelenting on Trump, and how could you not be? But Bush not only invited Dana to the White House after he lost, they became friends. They became friends. And as you'll hear, the interview with Dana is very much about how we developed the political satire on SNL during what I think was a pretty good period of political satire on the show. So our idea of political satire on the show was to do well-observed political satire. Now, this was before Trump, obviously. There is no way to do well-observed satire on Donald Trump and not be as vicious as possible. Or, for that matter, for McConnell and the rest of the Republicans who are just being so craven now. Lindsey Graham, for example. Remember that weird tirade at the end of the Kavanaugh hearings?
To my Republican colleagues, if you vote no, you're legitimizing the most despicable thing I have seen in my time in politics. You want this seat? I hope you never get it. I hope you're on the Supreme Court. That's exactly where you should be. And I hope that the American people will see through this charade.
Now, the only proper response to that was this. That move was from a piece that I co-wrote entitled The Sarcastic Clapping Family of Southampton. Here's an excerpt, Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks, and that week's host, Kevin Bacon.
Now that we're all here, I'd just like to say one thing. I know that some of you would like to challenge Father's will. After all, Meg and I did do rather well. And maybe Blake and Cosima think that's unfair. Of course, I certainly respect your right to do whatever you feel you have to do. But, for God's sakes, before we start getting lawyers in here and fighting each other like greedy rats, let's remember one thing. We're a family, dammit. A family! Because there's a lot more at stake here than mere dollars and cents. There's the memory of a man we all love. The man we called Father.
Quite a performance, Jeffrey. Oh, quite a performance indeed. Considering the fact that you hated Father. No, don't act so shocked, Jeffrey. We all know that you were just waiting for Father to die so you could get your filthy hands on all his money!
Nice speech, Cosima. Very nice. Considering you hadn't seen Father in almost 2 years...
Okay, now speaking of McConnell, my biggest hope for the 2020 election is that we not only take the White House and keep the House, but that we get 250 in the Senate. That's our goal, and it's going to be hard. But if we do, McConnell and the Republicans have been playing so dirty over the last 5 years. Here's what I suggest Democrats do if we get the White House and the 50 Democrats in the Senate. Okay. There is no age requirement on Supreme Court justices. The framers just did not put one in. So in 2021, when, say, Justice Ginsburg decides to retire, say, the new president appoints a 12-year-old. That's right. Say, Ginsburg's oldest great-granddaughter. Reliable liberal, continues to live at home till she goes to college. Now, McConnell, when the president names the 12-year-old as the nominee, McConnell will go, "You can't do that! You can't!" And we'll say, "Oh, yes, we can!" And then say Breyer decides to retire, replace him with a 3-year-old, say Merrick Garland's youngest granddaughter. Now, if you think of it, after serving on the court, I don't know what, it would be like 80, 90 years, And, you know, think of the medical advances by then. I mean, so 90 years after serving on the court from 90, she will be the most seasoned justice in the history of the court, the three-year-old. It's time we play hardball. That's all I'm saying. Play hardball. Okay, hang on for my discussion with Dana Carvey, who I think, by the way, does the best Trump I have ever heard. You know, normally I do issues, political issues, but George H.W. Bush, his memorial was a few days ago, and John Meacham, the presidential historian, mentioned Dana. And
yes.
Basically, now, Dana, he said to the crowd that you have said that doing an impression of George H.W. Bush was John Wayne doing Mr. Rogers, but I read that you said it was Mr. Rogers trying to do John Wayne. Did he have it wrong?
Yeah, dead wrong. No, I don't. I think what I normally do with these things, and I didn't even do it right in the editorial. I think I would start with John Wayne and then move toward Mr. Rogers. So, well, let's go over the ridge, you know, and then move toward Mr. Rogers. Beautiful day in the neighborhood, you know. So there's something there, but I don't know if it was John Wayne doing Ms. Rogers doing John Wayne. But
okay,
I like John
Meacham. Is supposed to be a presidential historian, and he's supposed to get things right.
Well, he interviewed me for the book, and I probably led him astray intentionally, never thinking that he would use it in a public forum. No, I have no idea, but it's definitely John Wayne and Mr. Rogers. Yes.
You wrote a beautiful piece in the New York Times about George H.W. Bush and your relationship. What was great about it was that he invited you down to the White House after he lost, right?
Yes.
And you asked where you're going to stay?
I did. I was very nervous talking to him, yeah. And I did say, where would I stay? And there was that long pause, so suddenly...
Oh, there was a long pause. So he wasn't intending to stay in the Lincoln bedroom.
We never talked about whether that was his intention or not, but it definitely... I said that, where would I stay? Pause. Well, you can stay right here in the White House with Barr and I. And I didn't know if he thought I was negotiating. I wasn't. But anyway, it was a funny moment. Where would I stay?
And let me ask you about Barr.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a difference between Barr and H.W. in temperament, or there was.
Yes.
And you told me that Barr was a little skeptical of you.
I think she was protective of her husband, and I don't, you know, they assumed maybe that we were Democrats or something. I don't know. So I felt
maybe
she
was because you did a fundraiser for the DNC. In 1991 or 90,
right.
At the Kennedy Center?
Yes, which Lorne invited me to do that. And then, but that was the first time I got that sense of George Bush Sr., how different he was, because we went over to the White House the next day. That was the very first time I met him. I didn't have it in the op-ed, but it was only very brief. But I remember him saying, hope you guys had a good event last night.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's funny. Well, and at that point, he was at like 93% approval rating because the Gulf War just ended.
Yes. But at the dinner that we had in the White House, we had a lot of meals and dinners. And we walked around. It was all kinds of stuff. It was too short of to do the whole story. Barbara at one point would start referring to the media. And she goes, I just don't like it when they say untrue things about my friend down there, and pointed at her husband. And then President Bush said, well, we said no politics. And that was the end of it, you know.
Okay, but he was, you know, he was the Bush who didn't invade Iraq.
Well, that was the mandate. That was the coalition. And I guess Colin Powell, I don't know if he said it to both presidents, if you break it, it's yours, you know.
Right, and he was right about that. So, in your article, you write about Lovitz. And the article starts with Lovitz calling you and saying you won.
Yes. And I talked to John right before I came here. And, yeah, that's pretty much how the conversation went. within reason.
Well, yeah. I was with John on election night.
So you had a different experience.
Well, no, I had actually kind of the same experience. Basically, yeah. What happened was I had campaigned for Dukakis, and mm-hmm. they invited me and John up, John to do Dukakis, and me
right.
to be the MC of his victory party on election night.
Mm.
So, which I started with, either we're going to win, it's going to be really, we're just going to win very, very tight, a very close yeah. race.
Yeah.
Or we'll win with a landslide. That was my first joke, because by the time yeah. it started, it wasn't looking good.
Didn't look good.
They had flown us up in this really small private jet or something, and then mm-hmm. we had to go back, and I had to write. It was a Tuesday night, obviously. And I'm with John in this plane, and I'm looking down at the lights. It was a beautiful, clear night,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking about the majesty of democracy. And, you know, I'm a little sad, but mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, like, you know, what a great country we are. I'm looking down, and then mm-hmm. John says, fuck, Bush is president. And I went like, well, yeah, but, you know, that's the way the system works. And he said, fucking Dana gets to do the president.
I don't, did he really say it like that?
He did that.
That's funny. I don't. Yeah,
he did it. Maybe he did it with a little more humor in it, but
right.
not much. And he he really had been counting on doing the cold openings, which you ended up doing. I went through a file of cold openings, and you mm-hmm. just we depended on you to open the show.
We did a lot of cold openings.
Yeah.
And sometimes we didn't start until Friday night or Saturday morning.
Well, which is okay, because
yeah.
The cold opening
current.
Should be. The one thing about doing a live show is that you can respond to...
Yeah, and it was a guy in a chair essentially facing forward with a lockdown shot, made it super easy.
Okay, and they killed, but I called Lorne on Saturday saying, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do for Bush? And he was thinking of the Bush-Dukakis debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew why he was doing it, because it got the biggest laugh of the year, I think.
Yeah, it was a classic, that
yeah.
one.
Yeah. And but you didn't have Bush.
No, not at all.
No, and so I said, well, Dana doesn't really have Bush there, and also it's just making fun of Bush. I mean, really, it wasn't Bush at his best. We're going to play that. And this is you before you got it.
Okay.
Not bad. And let me explain where this is. This is Diane Sawyer, played by Jan Hooks wonderfully, is the moderator. And you've been asked a question, and mm-hmm. You don't have much of an answer. And
right.
at a certain point, you end your answer, and then she says this.
You still have a minute 20, Mr. Vice President.
Well, sure, more has to be done, but the program is in place. Make no mistake, we are doing the job. So let's just stay the course and keep on track. Stay the course.
You still have 50 seconds left, Mr. Vice President.
Well, let me just sum up. On track, stay the course, 1,000 points of light, stay the course.
Mm-hmm. Governor Dukakis, rebuttal.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
Okay, so
yeah,
naturally, Lorne goes, biggest laugh of the season, probably that season.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what we're going to put on. And I just say, you know, remember when Bush came on the show? And he was on tape, but he was on the show, which showed what a great, unbelievably great sport he was.
Yes.
And this is, you came back to host at mm-hmm. the, what, in October of 93 or something?
Something like that, or later in the year, whatever. Yeah,
and
around that time.
So we got, and they played this, like, on CNN and mm-hmm. all over the place, but I'm going to play it, too.
Sure.
And so let's play that.
Daniel, George Bush here. I'm watching you do your impression of me, and I got to say, it's nothing like me. Bears no resemblance. It's bad. It's bad.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I think it's a fair impression.
Don't see it.
You know?
It's totally exaggerated. Not me, those crazy hand gestures. The pointing thing, I don't do them. And also, na-ga-da, never said it. In all my years of government service, I never once said na-ga-da.
Let's talk about the impression, because I think this will be interesting to the folks out there. So it took you a few cold openings after he's president to get there, right?
Yeah, definitely. To find some rhythms and hooks. I was kind of monotone, and the writing was actually pretty funny, though, like I say in the op-ed, you know, stay
well,
the Downey,
course. Well, Downey and I would do those cold openings. Jim Downey, the greatest political satirist in the history of the show, he stayed on after I left. He did the Gore Bush debate.
I put it in a lockbox.
Also strategery. And yep. I think that decided the election, because everyone knew that Bush was kind of inarticulate and et cetera. Mm-hmm. They knew all the Bush stuff, but he had Gore sighing, and he did the lockbox, the repetitive lockbox, and a certain superciliousness. Mm-hmm. And that was 500 votes in Florida.
You know what?
Blame Jim Downey.
It's terrifying to think that Saturday Night Live has that kind of power, but yeah. I think it's definitely influential. Yeah.
No, evidently the Gore campaign showed him the sketch and said, you can't do this in the next debate. No, I really do believe that Jim changed the course of history with that.
Yes. And yes, he knows it too. But I think that you're right. I mean, things will not get a laugh unless there's some type of truth underneath it. You know, so it's holding up a mirror like this is what they're laughing their ass off at.
But on this, like strategery, which Bush had never said, by the way. And so that was Jim Downey. And and the Bush people loved it.
Yeah.
They put on one door office of strategery and the Eisenhower office building, the building across right next to the White House. It was interesting because we did something, we did an election special that year, like the night before the election or something, and we had both Bush and Gore do something, you know, and
yes,
Bush's team and Bush wanted his stuff, his malapropism, he wanted to be bigger. He knew what the caricature of him was, and he wanted to do it. And
yes.
And the Gore team was much more controlled, and you know, Gore was looser, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean, I think you know that.
I was there that day, by the way. I met W and Al Gore that day. I think I was guest hosting or somehow I was doing a guest spot or something. But I remember
you were probably
doing
wraparounds for the special. We would do these political specials.
Like 4 years, 2000,
right before the election. Yeah.
So it made Bush W kind of likable. I guess.
He's very likable, and I hate saying that because he was a terrible president. I mean, he inherited a balanced budget and left us in huge debt, and also, you know, with the worst economy since the Great Depression. So there's that. I don't know how much Cheney and Rumsfeld and those guys had to do with it versus how much Bush had to do with it. But Bush's Saddam had tried to kill his father, so there's that. They did not have weapons of mass destruction. They had nothing to do with 9/11. Everyone knows this who's listening to this. And it was a tragedy.
Well, Bill Clinton obviously set up regime change, but, you know, I've been maybe during the Lewinsky thing, and then a lot of the Dems did jump in on that, which always mystified me, you know, supported the invasion.
Oh,
know?
Yeah, most of them did.
Yeah, so that's what really put it over the top, right?
But you liked him, right?
Well, I only met him very briefly, and he was just charming, you know. But so was Al Gore. Remember we did that event with Al Gore in Marin County, I think. And he's a very loose, likable guy. I mean, a lot of politicians, I think Al was, Mr. Gore was overhandled a little bit too. You know, there is that. It's a very fine line between overhandling your candidate, you know.
It's interesting when like Beto, O'Rourke this year. Had no consultants, and he was great. And so sometimes maybe that's the way to go, but don't.
Right. We'll see. He had no pressure. He's coming from behind. Hopefully he won't change things up. But I think he's the guy they're going to put up, if I had to guess right now.
You know, this is the thing about you that I promise, by the way, to blow a lot of smoke up your ass if you do this.
I know. I was waiting. I'm fine.
The thing about here is the ass blowing begins now.
Here it begins, coming in.
So you know politics. You know politics. And you're not a partisan, though. And
no.
You're not, I think you're probably progressive, but you're not a real partisan. And we felt on the show, Jim Downey, who I talked about, is a conservative. He's brilliant, and he's a thoughtful conservative. I have not talked to him about Trump, but I can't believe he'd. I mean, I don't think Trump is conservative.
Trump's an anomaly. You know, I like to read the opposite. I always tell people, read the opposite. So I read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times every morning with my cup of coffee, because when I see consensus, I find it very interesting. You know, like, say, if a Wall Street Journal does a more dire thing about climate change, it gets my attention more. Or if the New York Times says something critical of the Obama administration, it gets my attention. So I would say read the opposite.
Do you read the op-ed?
I do. I mean, I don't read every single one, but, you know, I find them very interesting. That's sort of, you know, the incendiary voices, the media voices get all the attention. But at least there's some thoughtful, smartly written editorials, whether you agree or disagree, in the Wall Street Journal. It's not scorched or as quite as over the top as like the evening shows, you know.
Yeah, well, I actually... Well, not as Fox, but it's pretty close. I got to say, the Wall Street Journal editorial. You and I can disagree on that, but
just for example, they take a lot of shots at Trump, and they think he's completely has no idea what trade is or what he's doing. So that they agree
it's the
with
Wall Street Journal. They love trade. What I was getting at was, you knew exactly what every political thing we had you do was. In fact, you wrote some of it. And that was a very, very much a plus, because we're working with a fully operating vessel, you know, and so you knew every nuance of everything we were doing and were adding to it. I'm trying to think of where that made. Oh, I know. Do you remember when we were going to go on a 2-week break and you said, I'm thinking of doing Tsongas. Can you work on that?
Yes.
And I said, sure, I'll work on it. We were going on a 2-week break. And so I started playing with Tsongas, and I realized like that he was Snagglepuss with a Massachusetts accent.
So he was like a dollar. I'm not going to spend your dollars. I'm, not Santa Claus.
And then he'd always cough.
It was funny. That was an example of an impression that if any viewer had never seen Tsongas, it was a really, really funny character. You know.
We're going to play this. But here's the thing. So I come back. So I go to the Kennedy School to give a thing about, you know, political comedy or something. I trot out the Tsongas I've figured out.
Yeah.
And it gets...
Yeah, we're going to fix the economy.
You know, and they go, I'm going like, oh, man, fuck. Dana wants to do Tsongas, but I've got it. So I come back, and I say to you, you know, Dana, I know you asked me to think about Tsongas, and... I got it in a way that I think is really, I'd like to do it. I'd like to do it. And you went, I'll do Brown. Do you remember that?
Brown. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. Absolutely.
And then you immediately started doing Brown, and it wasn't 100% there. Now, you're a Californian, so you knew him.
Yeah.
But you actually got his way of thinking about politics and about, you just got him, And I got to play this. This was, so we did a Star Trek convention. You remember that?
This one, you came out and it was just instant, huge laughs. I mean, just.
Yeah, and yeah. This is not under the heading of blowing smoke up your ass in a way, because I get more laughs than this. But
right, I was blowing smoke up your ass while you were trying to blow smoke up my ass. There was smoke and there were asses. No one knows where the smoke was going.
Okay, let's do this. But I think this Brown is brilliant. And this is all three candidates at that time. It was Brown and Tsongas and Clinton come talk to a Star Trek convention. We're trying to limit the use of these, so we're just going to do Brown and Tsongas.
Former California Governor Jerry Brown spoke to the 17th annual Star Trek convention at the O'Hare Marriott Hotel. Our C-SPAN camera, the only camera we have, was there, as was our microphone.
Thank you, Trekkers. Thank you very much. Now, I want to say that 23 years ago this fall, Star Trek was canceled. And I think it's a shame and a travesty that we don't have a single primetime science fiction show on our network schedules today. And in the 60s, if you look at what we did out there in California, we had Outer Limits, we had the Twilight Zone, Star Trek, as well as Lost in Space. And now, all we've got is Star Trek The Next Generation, and that's in syndication. Now, some people say there's not enough audience for science fiction on television. But if you go back and look at it, and look at when Star Trek was canceled, it had a 21% share of the audience. Now, today, that's a hit. That's a Knots Landing or a Tequila and Bonetti. Now, we have this giant bloated Nielsen system in place, and it just perpetuates itself. Now, but under my plan, what we have is a mandatory 13% flat audience share, so shows like Doctor Who or Alien Nation can stay on and have a chance to develop. And you won't have bankrupt programming, you know, like Madlock with Andy Griffith. And I'm sorry, but he hasn't had a new idea in 20 years. And I'll say it to Andy Griffith's face. I mean, he may be an honorable man, but what he's doing is just business as usual.
Some of those laughs, in case you're listening to that and going like, what? I don't. There were cutaways to the Trekkies.
Right, yeah.
So there was Farley Spade and just the whole group of them being Trekkies. And by the way, that voice, the C-SPAN announcer voice, is Downey.
Of course.
Okay, so now we're going to go to Tsongas, I guess, right?
Later that day, former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas addressed the same gathering.
Okay. Okay, now earlier... Jerry Brown talked about Star Trek, okay? And he put himself forward as, the Star Trek candidate, okay? Okay, but I was, the first candidate to carry around the Star Trek lunchbox, okay? Okay, now, when Jerry Brown talks about Star Trek.
Okay, we can. That's okay, enough of that. That's enough of that. You get the idea.
Well, yeah,
Well,
it was a funny voice.
It was, and of course, attitude. Now it's been how many years is it? That's 1992.
Yeah, 26.
So 26 years ago. So there's a lot of people going, huh?
Yeah, right. But he was the front runner at that time. He won Iowa, right?
I think he won New Hampshire.
New Hampshire?
Because Clinton was second and called himself the comeback kid because it was after Jennifer Flowers and the draft stuff.
So he was viable, I think, the week we did that. At least.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
No.
He so that gave it
viable,
energy.
And I don't know how viable Brown was, but he had run against Carter. So he ran in 76.
Yes.
You know what? Brown has done a brilliant job in California, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, I think, and Brown had said it himself, if Brown was 72 somehow right now, he might be the front runner for the Democratic nomination,
California has done amazingly well under him. They've balanced the budget, which, what he inherited from Schwarzenegger was nothing like that. And he's just been a great governor, and California's been doing incredibly well, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's an example of I like someone like him who can still kind of surprise you. Obviously, he's a Democrat, but he was a Jesuit And he really wanted to have a rainy day fund. You know, that side of him was conservative, which California really needs. So we have a fairly decent one. I think it's $16 billion, you know. But that was part of his, you know, he was an asymmetrical character. I mean, that's why we made fun of him. You know, satellites.
That's why the Trekkie convention made so much sense
a little bit. That, yeah, he would get into it in that fashion.
Yeah. And I think you probably wrote that, maybe you and Jim. And it was great to have somebody who, when we were writing, you know, Downey and I were, you know, political junkies, but we were
definitely
writing with somebody who also was.
Well, I think it influenced me a little bit because it was interesting for the listeners that Jim was conservative. I don't know how far conservative, but I'd never met sort of an intellectual conservative before. Jim kind of surprised me because you think Harvard grad, New York, Saturday Night Live, that he would be liberal. But it was, I think it ended up being kind of nice having you on one side, Jim on the other, but both, you know, agreeing most of the time or finding consensus. So that was kind of interesting, wasn't it? It informed the writing a little bit.
Well, we had the same philosophy, which was the job of this show is not to have a political agenda. And because we had too many people on the show. You had this cast, you had other writers, you had production people, but especially the cast and the writers. And we felt our job was to do sort of informed, funny stuff. Downey had the thing, which is reward people for knowing more, but don't punish them for knowing less.
Right.
So we did stuff that was, you know, the people who don't know a lot could get, but also if you knew more, you got some other stuff. And so Jim, very conservative, and he kept me honest, so we didn't do stuff that was too progressive or too liberal. And we thought that was the proper thing. That's what SNL was supposed to be about. And like a show like Murphy Brown, right?
Yeah.
That's created by one person, Diane English.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Candace Bergen, the star, is a liberal. Mm-hmm. And so that can be a liberal show.
If you go down one ideological road, then there can be hypocrisy or things that you will not satirize because it's not where your ideological road leads you. So we would lead to wherever the truth was, right? So then the administrations kept changing.
That's what we did, Dana.
Well, we made fun of Bill Clinton. Well, we made fun of Bill Clinton. We didn't like, you know, kind of not make fun of Bill Clinton because he was a Democrat. It's pretty obvious. Do you want me to do my Clinton?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I just thought it was interesting. This goes back a little bit when Hillary fainted a couple times during the campaign, and Bill went on actually Charlie Rose and Cave tried to make everything okay, but seemed to make it worse. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, she's a fainter. I mean, she faints a lot. I mean, she's a little itty bitty thing, and she's got a low center of gravity, which I find adorable. But you get some humidity, and she just goes, it becomes a whirling dervish, and it's just timber time. See, there's making fun of a liberal.
Oh yeah, well you can't not make fun of Bill Clinton
or Donald Trump. He talks in the strength. I haven't done that much work on it, honestly. If I was on Saturday Night Live, but he has the craziest ADD repeating words, odd, bizarre. You're going to be happy. You're asking me. Excuse me. Interrupts himself. Excuse me. Many people are saying, you're going to be happy. You're asking me, are you going to be happy? You're going to be happy. Happy like you wouldn't believe. You're going to be so happy. I just never heard anyone really talk like that. And it's fascinating. Later on, what I decided when I was to try to do it, I decided it was Regis and Brando. And so I stopped with Regis Philbin. But you think about it, you know, Galbraith's over there. They're crazy, right? So it's that kind of New York rhythm. What can I do for you, my son? And then you lead yourself to Regis and you put them together. You got Donald Trump. So that was my my latest way to do it. But I do a lot of him and Obama back and forth because I think that
let's hear that.
Well, the thing about Obama
is paid their money for this.
Obama could really sing, right? We never had a president, maybe Nixon, Darlene Clementine at the piano. But Obama'd get up there and we're going to do the things that we got to do. And then he'd go, Amazing Grace. And it was like really good. So I thought, well, what honestly would Trump sing? The cookie and the creepy, the kind of ooky ooky, the cookie and the creepy, that a family. Sorry. Okay.
So Bush. How did we go from the Bush Dukakis debate, where you're not there, to when you got him?
Well, like I said in the article, I was trying to find hooks. It was just going to be monotone. And just kind of, I never really sat and watched tape for hours, but I guess I saw him here and there. But the way I remember it, which I said in the piece, was why I was with you hanging out. We were just sitting there. I don't know exactly what was going on, but I remember just at that moment kind of waving my finger in the air and kind of doing that lazy syntax Texas draw that people doing that thing in that whole area over there. And I think you laughed, and then we both laughed. And I think that was a keyhole. We was like, okay. And then we found Not Gonna Do It with Jim and everything and other hooks. It's
that's
bad.
Why you like to work with people who laugh.
Laughter is oxygen. There are comedians who don't laugh that hard, you know? You're not that person. You laugh very hard, and it's great. I mean, it's great when you're in the room and someone is really, really laughing. Jim Downey, Jim would smile and kind of, like, start thinking about the next line. But, yeah, you would cackle.
But if you got a laugh from Jim, then you were going like, oh, I got a laugh from Jim. But, okay, right. So you get the kind of the thing over there,
doing that
whole
thing.
Area.
Yeah, out of breath, a little deeper. I was a little higher up in the early, down a little deeper, doing that thing in that area over there, that area is there, whether you're there or not, doing that thing it does and the way it does it. You know, that's like a little song at the end where he would complete thoughts, doing that thing the way he does it. You know, Sometimes it would fall down at the end.
Yeah. And I remember when we got, I think early on, another hook was Not Gada.
Yes.
And that was, I may have said something like the laziness sometimes where he does like, Not Gonna Do It.
Right.
I think that's where we got to.
Yeah.
Then you got to Not Gada.
It became, and then there was nowhere else to go. Once Not Going to Do It became Not Gada.
Man. You could kill with that thing. So we wrote this thing where it was a progression. And it was, I'll do it, not anywhere near as well as you would do it. But it was basically, you know, this vial of crack was found in Lafayette Park just across the street from the White House. This hypodermic was found on the White House lawn. And this bag of cocaine was found right here in the Oval Office, 2 feet from my desk. It's getting bad. It's bad.
This is cocaine crack. I'll tell you something. This crack was bought right here in the White House, 3 feet from this desk.
So that's the progression.
Right. That was the jokes. Yeah.
You're doing it in dress. You're getting so many laughs, and it's mainly with your hands. You're doing your hands.
Yeah, yeah.
You do facial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That between the vial of crack in Lafayette Park and the bag of coke 2 feet from your desk, it's like 3 minutes.
No way. I know. I was milking the cow. Yeah, I got you.
Well, but Jim and I had to go to Dana between dress and air and say, Dana, you got to get fewer laughs. People are missing the through line.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened actually before.
Oh, yeah. And many, many times I think that, you know, when you do the cold opening, you're there's a lockdown shot. You're facing the audience. The whole audience is amped up. The show is starting. And if you have nonverbal comedy, like waving, it's scary, and then I'm waving my arms like crazy, they're really laughing. So as a comedian, it's a horse to water. I'm going to do a little more of that and then a little more of that. And sometimes I knew that I'd gone too far. I would kind of come off and go, okay, wait a minute.
Well, here's the smoke up your ass.
All right, here we go.
Here it is.
I'm recording this part of the show for my private time later.
I have never heard of a writer telling a performer, at least at SNL, but I don't think anywhere else, to not get so many laughs. I don't know of anybody's ever told a comedian to not get so many laughs. So that's in like in the history of comedy.
That's very flattering. The one other little weird flattering thing that happened to me when I did Joe Montana and Walter Payton on Church Chat, you know, and it was vaudevillian, right? Let's get the pigskin, Joey, and squeeze it through our, you know, that thing. But this old Teamster sound man or something stopped me after the show and said they've never peaked that high. He was the sound man. I never had a sound that loud in the studio.
So, from the laughs.
Yeah, from the laughs of that sketch. He said it was the highest he'd seen the meter go. But
that's
I would say
really
Massive Head Wound Harry probably topped it later, which I did not write, but that was...
Head Wound Harry was something Rob Schneider wrote.
And, I didn't know that. Probably you and Smigel, everybody...
No. You know who put the thing at the end on was Tom Davis.
Okay.
At the rewrite.
Yeah.
And this is what it is. Massive Head Wound Harry was this guy comes to a party and he's got a massive head wound.
Open. It's an open wound.
Open, basically. Massive head wound. That's very key that it's open.
Yes.
So it's just a party that everyone is getting bummed out. And
yeah.
Okay. So Davis in the rewrite says, why don't we have somebody there who's blind with a seeing eye dog?
Mm-hmm.
And why don't we rub the wound with cooked shrimp?
Mm-hmm.
And we all go, that's brilliant.
That was the hardest laugh or the loudest I'd heard it in the studio was those moments. And again, it wasn't jokes you had to listen to. It was just seeing the fight between the dog trying to rip the wig off my head. But
well,
it was
first
the
he was
yeah,
there was
a,
actually a flap on the wound.
Yes.
And he was pulling at the flap.
Yes.
Which was that I think mainly that was, and then what was the line at the end? Do you remember the line at the end?
He must smell my dog. But for real comedy for real comedy aficionados, because the sketch had gone so well, I did not want the wig to come completely off and make it about that. So you'll see my hand reach up and I'm holding the wig on my temple. And so that, of course, kept the tug of war going, you know, and that's why it really went to such a crescendo. The dog did not need the dog.
There
finally
you have a veteran performer.
Yeah, thank you.
Who knows that if the wig comes off, everyone begins to go like, oh, we're at a moment where a wig got...
Yeah, it's about something else.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing happened in The Pepper Boy with Adam Sandler, where Chris Farley had one line. We are these fanatical Italian pepper guys. You like a pepper? You want the pepper? It's a very sexual, I think it was. But Farley had one line. Well, thank you, Pepper Boy. But on the air show, Chris went, why thank you, Pepper Boy? And just Sandler turned purple. And he turns to me, and I didn't want him to, and I said in the Italian accent, I leaned into him and said, don't a break.
And he broke a lot.
He broke a lot. But in that sketch, he turned away and held it because it was the same thing. The sketch was just hitting on all cylinders, and I didn't want it to be about that, you know. So... That's two.
We had an ethic in that Lorne started with was don't break.
But yeah, Lorne terrified us that way. You know, it's Carol Burnett. You don't want to break. You know what I mean?
Oh, good, Lorne.
Yes. My Lorne impression?
Yeah, I love your Lorne impression. I can't. I've worked there 15 years. I can't do a Lorne impression. Let me hear your Lorne impression.
Well, I'll tell you a quick little story because he knew that I did it incessantly, but I never really did it for him. He asked me once on an airplane, and again, I kind of, that's not very good. But then maybe 3 years ago, I was in an Italian restaurant with Lorne and Rob Lowe. Long story. And he goes, how did you do it? And I said, Lorne, really, the beginning was you on a Wednesday night at the bulletin board. You're in there. Al's in there. Everyone's trying to find the show. And it's frustrating. Like,
this is after read-through. We've had a long read-through.
The read-through wasn't that great, and cards are going on indicating the sketches in the show and then coming off, and it was frustrating. And Lorne, before he would go use the restroom behind him, would say, this was the first hook, how I got Lorne. I still have no fucking first act. Right? And then he would go to the bathroom. So I did that for Lorne, and he was fine. He was flattered. You know, it wasn't... But it's a fantastic rhythm. You'll enjoy the podcast, Dana. It's that thing of like a flow of conversation. You know, it's a fun, it's an exaggeration, but I love Lorne.
Do his no.
No, 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 no. Anytime Lorne would do a thesis and you would ask a question, he would do this backpedaling motorboat sound. You know, it's that thing of like you find you'll have new friends. Well, wouldn't you still be friends? No, don't misunderstand me. It's that thing of like, you know, no.
So I wrote in one sketch where, you know, where I put Lorne in the sketch, and I wrote no comma. And
he went, funny.
No, in read through.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, man, come on.
Now, you know, I mean, I have a lot of affection for him. When I was there at the time, I was a young man. I didn't really know what he was doing in the trenches. When I hosted it and hung out with him all week, I went, man, he is working hard. I mean, he really slaves over that show emotionally. It's like a big, big, big thing. So, but he's paced himself. He's still there. God bless him.
Just had his, I think, 74th.
Yeah. Wow. No, his mind is very sharp. Last time I was there, usually I'd leave the party after the show, Saturday Night Live, like at 3:30, you know, or 4. But that night I decided, I don't know, life's short. I'm going to stay to the end. And Lorne talked brilliantly, extemporaneously for 5 hours, and I was talking too, but until the lights came up, and it was kind of nice. I said, I'll stay to the end and see what that's like. And it was like 6 a.m.,
No, it was, we had the weirdest schedule there. I'd stay till about 3 or 3:30.
Yeah.
Or 4.
After putting in an 18-hour day at that point, you know.
Right, but you, crazy. You have your juices flowing. I mean, you can't go right to bed after doing a live show to, you know, however many million people. And And you're discussing the show with your cohorts, with with the other writers and performers.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's just fun. And then you stay until 3:30, 4. You go home, and you wake up, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. And then you go to bed again at like 3. SNL basically began at 5 p.m. on Monday.
Yes.
With a host meeting.
Mm-hmm.
With everyone pitching fake ideas.
Yeah.
And so that's like, you know.
The Game of Thrones. Don't let them hear my idea before I read it for them and read through, right? To get the laughs, to get it on the show.
Oh, no. It was just you didn't have an idea.
Oh, you didn't have an idea. Except Jack Handy had already finished his idea because he takes a bath. And then Jack was the only guy who never procrastinated. But most comedy writers, you know, just keep thinking, ordering food, thinking. I mean, I would leave sometimes on a Tuesday at 3, and nothing really had been written in a major way, you know. But by 2 o'clock the next day, they were all there.
So I wanted to. Oh, I know, I wanted to play because I wanted to talk about how this came about when he's talking about war. This is Bush again.
Oh, okay.
None of us want war in that whole area out over there. But as Commander-in-Chief, I am ever cognizant of my authority to launch a full-scale orgy of death there on the desert sand. Probably won't, but then again, I might.
There's the hands.
Now, if we do... we do go to war, I can assure you it will not be another Vietnam, because we have learned, well, the simple lesson of Vietnam. Stay out of Vietnam.
Okay, that line was written by Bob Odenkirk.
Yes, the way I recall it, you and I were sitting around, and I think you started with talking about Vietnam or something like that.
I said, we've learned the lesson of Vietnam, but then I didn't have a joke.
And then Bob approached, right? Or he wasn't there the whole time. He just came over and it seemed like, yeah. And then he goes, stay out of Vietnam. And then you laughed and wrote it down. It's fantastic.
That's how things work when things are working.
When things are working. Yeah, there I was in full bloom as far as having the impression and the audience discovering the impression. And when you're waving your arms around like they're Sidewinder missiles and there's no beginning, middle, or end, you just kind of go off the audience. It's a, you know, it's a fun place to be. And then there's an example of a performance, and then the writing was so clever right after it. So it was like, it was operating on all cylinders.
Yeah, and also there was something about the rhythm of the voice and the flatness of the voice to say, we've learned the lesson of... Can you do it?
We've learned the lesson of Vietnam. Stay out of Vietnam. It won't attack, but it could. You know, it became a character as well as an impression. This jumpy, kind of hyperactive, kind of whispery, kind of, you know, that all that energy was just sort of coming from him doing barely doing that and then extrapolating it. But it was enough that the audience bought it and loved it. So I don't know. It wasn't Ross Perot.
But now Ross Perot, I brought you in.
a billionaire with all the answers running for president.
I had remember three-quarter videotape?
Yes, and I remember you playing that for me, yes.
And I said, Dana, there is this guy, Ross Perot, and he wasn't that far along yet.
Yeah.
And I put it in and played, I don't know, 3 minutes of him or something,
mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
You said, oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
A fully formed comic character.
Yes, which I thought was sort of a bookend to Sarah Palin with Tina Fey. Some people you do impressions of, you don't have to make great leaps. It's kind of all there. It's a funny persona. And Perot, absolutely.
Immediately you had him, right?
I had him, but then the confidence comes and the audience recognizes him more. The first sketch you had written, and I had him, it was good. But it went a little further. I didn't quite have the Larry King banter. Can I finish one time? Can I finish one time? Larry, why do you insist on interrupting me? Can I finish one time, Larry? Just, are you going to interrupt me all day long? So that once that came about, that was instantly as fun as Bush. You know, it was just, and then it really took off, you know. About 2 years ago, I was at the Palm Restaurant in Beverly Hills. I rarely ever go there. But all of a sudden, I'm in a booth. Larry King sidles up next to me. I want you to call my wife and tell her you're Ross Perot. So he gives me the phone, and I was just in the restaurant next to Larry King, another big laugher, laughing his ass off. And I'm going, I got to be honest, Larry is completely shit-faced right now. Now, he is drunk off his ass. Someone's got to come get him. He's not in good shape. Can I finish one time? You know, so... And Larry just loved it. So
now you won the Emmy for that year, right?
Let me check. I guess yes. No, very incredibly flattering because the category we were always up against acrobats and other. I don't know. It was this, you know, kind of bizarre category. So it was very flattering to win. But I had a lot of momentum that year with Wayne's World and Perot and Bush. You know, it was a lot of stuff happened at once.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was, I think you were shoo-in that year because you carried the season. I mean, Perot and Bush really carried that season, and of course, Wayne's World was so popular. Well, Dana, thanks. I think we have achieved what we wanted. I've blown the smoke.
Smoke been blown. Let me sum it up, Al. Disclaiming this undisclosed location in L.A., patching in, podcast talking. Bush, Perot, Massive head wound, Harry.
Perfect. That's your ear. That's your ear. Ending on massive head wound, Harry.
Harry. That was a good word. That's a good phrase for him. And to go down on Harry is funny because it doesn't make any sense. Like, who would do that?
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it's been fun, Al. Let's do it again.
Well, there you have it. You can see what a jerk Dana is and how hard he was to work with. By the way, that beautiful music is from Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.